Today is Thursday, December 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Britain approves another COVID-19 vaccine, but what does it mean for the rest of the world?
Developing countries with less sophisticated cold chain and with smaller budgets will be able to use this vaccine.
Plus, more than 20 were killed during a rocket attack at the Aden Airport.
Amateur video showed a crater alongside the terminal where one of the rockets hit. Many windows and metal frames appear to have been blown out.
We'll have these stories and more next. Britain approved another vaccine for the coronavirus on Wednesday, this one developed by Oxford University and the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca. As Henry Ridgewell reports, scientists say the vaccine could be a game changer in the global fight against the pandemic.
The approval of a new vaccine is welcome as Britain suffers a surge of coronavirus infections. Regulators say the Oxford University AstraZeneca vaccine has shown around 70% effectiveness against COVID-19, a relatively high figure compared to many vaccines for other diseases, and is safe to use. Dr. June Rain is the chief executive of the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency.
As I've said before, and I will say again today, the safety of the public always comes first.
The AstraZeneca vaccine is a boon for developing nations. It costs around $3 to $4 per dose and only needs to be stored at refrigerator temperatures. Dr. Simon Clark, a microbiologist at the University of Reading, spoke to VOA via Skype.
Developing countries with less sophisticated cold chain and with smaller budgets will be able to use this vaccine.
Earlier this month, several Western nations approved the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which is around 95% effective. But not only is it more expensive at around $20 per dose, it must be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius. Research into the optimum dosing regime for the AstraZeneca vaccine is ongoing. Britain plans to administer the first dose to as many people as possible, rather than focusing only on elderly and vulnerable groups. A second dose will follow up to 12 weeks later for longer-term protection. Again, Dr. Simon Clark of the University of Reading.
There is government pressure to increase the coverage of vaccination. And that's understandable. People want it done as quickly as possible. But if you end up putting more people in hospital because they're vulnerable and they didn't get the full regime of the vaccine, then that means that our hospitals are still going to be under pressure.
The British government has welcomed the approval as a cause for great optimism. British Health Secretary Matt Hancock.
We can now see our route out of this pandemic.
But the road to recovery will be difficult. Britain is struggling with a surge of infections driven by a new variant of the coronavirus that doctors say is over 50% more infectious. There are record numbers of hospitalizations, with patients being treated in ambulances as hospital beds are running short. Will Broughton is from the British College of Paramedics.
Control room staff are having to make incredibly difficult decisions to decide who gets an ambulance and in what order, quite often with huge numbers of people waiting for ambulances and they have nobody left to send.
Several cases of the new mutant virus have now been found in other countries. Scientists say its spread makes the global rollout of vaccines even more urgent. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Brazil will soon weigh emergency use approval for AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine as Latin America's largest country rushes to catch up with immunization programs underway around the hard-hit region. VOA has additional COVID-19 coverage on our website. Britain's House of Commons has voted resoundingly to approve a trade deal with the European Union, paving the way for an orderly break with the bloc that will finally complete the UK's years-long Brexit journey.
The ayes to the right, 521. Yay! The noes to the left, 73.
With just a day to spare, the lawmakers approved the agreement sealed between the United Kingdom and the European Union last week. It will become British law once it passes through the House of Lords and gets formal royal assent from Queen Elizabeth II. A rocket attack on Aden Airport, controlled by the Saudi-backed Yemeni government, President Abid Rabo Mansour Hadi, has left at least 22 people dead and 50 wounded. The attack took place as newly appointed government ministers arrived from the Saudi capital of Riyadh. Edward Uranian takes things from here.
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV showed video of rockets landing near the Aden Airport terminal as newly appointed government ministers were disembarking. Most of the casualties were reportedly inside the terminal. Amateur video showed a crater alongside the terminal where one of the rockets hit. Many windows and metal frames appeared to have been blown out. A van parked outside also appeared to have broken windows. Information Minister Muammar al-Ariani accused the Iranian-backed Houthi militia group, which controls the capital Sana'a, of launching the attack. The Houthis have denied responsibility. Government spokesman Raja Badi told Arab media that a Houthi drone was also spotted near Aden's Maishik Palace, where government ministers were taken for safety. Yemeni Prime Minister Maine Abdel Malik condemned the attack and called on Yemenis to unite against terrorism. Abdel Malik says he wishes a speedy recovery to the victims of what he calls a vile and cowardly act, which puts the new government at the focal point of its responsibilities. He also urges Yemenis to stand together in the fight against terrorism. The UN envoy to Yemen, Martin Griffiths, said in a statement that he strongly condemns the attack at Aden Airport upon the cabinet's arrival and the killing of many innocent civilians. This unacceptable act of violence is a tragic reminder of the importance of bringing Yemen urgently back on the path towards peace. The International Committee of the Red Cross in Yemen said a staff member was among those killed in the blast. Deputy Yemeni Information Minister Usama Sherem told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that the rocket attack targeted civilians inside the building who were waiting for a flight to Cairo. Most passengers on board the arriving Yemeni airliner carrying newly appointed government ministers appeared to be unharmed. The new Yemeni government was formed following a power-sharing agreement in Riyadh earlier in December between supporters of President Hadi and the Southern Separatist Movement, which fought Hadi's forces in Aden last year. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
In the past, Lebanon could count on wealthy Gulf Arab states to help bail it out of financial difficulties. But analysts say that's no longer true. Analysts say Lebanon's failure to condemn the 2016 mob attacks on Saudi Arabia's diplomatic missions in Iran began souring ties, and its Shiite Hezbollah militia connection to Iran has not helped. Dale Gavlek has more.
Lebanon should not expect Persian Gulf Arab states' help in bailing the country out from its severe financial and economic woes, according to analyst Emil Hokayem. The senior fellow for Middle East security at London's International Institute for Strategic Studies called past Gulf financial and political investments in Lebanon costly and bruising without achieving a clear outcome or benefit. Instead, Hokayem says Lebanese politicians milk those connections for local gains.
In Saudi, but also elsewhere, people realize that the Lebanese state nor the Hayy dynasty can do much about Hezbollah's support, for instance, for the Houthis right now in Yemen. And that goes to the heart of Gulf national security. Lebanon is also increasingly seen as a source of threat to the Gulf states, whether it's Hezbollah and assumed desire to manipulate and provoke or spy on behalf of the Iranians, on bribing the perception. So there is immense frustration.
Hokayem says that while Lebanese talent was central to the development of the Gulf states in the past, this is no longer the case, and there is a generational change of perception among the Gulf's younger leaders away from their elders, such as Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who he says have other priorities for their countries in the region. Still, Paul Salem, president of the Washington-based Middle East Institute, says he believes diplomacy by the incoming Biden administration and the United States and France could effectively address Lebanon's dire economic and political crisis beyond using sanctions to exert pressure on the country's politicians to bring about change.
I think we'll see a lot of American-French coordination. They should figure out not only to have the Europeans and the Americans coordinating, but we must get some of the big Gulf countries back on game. We got to figure out a game that works. We can't do it without the Gulf.
Lebanon's political impasse continues to deepen after a tentative deal on a new prime minister has unraveled. The political turmoil has left the country rudderless as it grapples with the worst economic crisis since the 1975-1990 civil war. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2018, a pair of astronomers discovered that an asteroid sharing Jupiter's solar orbit, but doing so in the opposite direction, was not originally a part of our solar system. Elena Mordais of the Sao Paulo State University and Fatih Namouni from the French National Center for Scientific Research determined the asteroid formed around another star, which billions of years ago resided in the same cluster as our sun. The scientists suggested that the relatively closeness of the stars at the time, along with their and their planet's gravitational forces, allowed for the exchange of asteroids from each other's systems. In a new study published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, the two astronomers have identified a population of 19 asteroids with interstellar origins, orbiting the sun between our solar system's giant planets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Last week, the government of Chad passed a law that grants expansive new rights to refugees fleeing persecution and hardship in neighboring countries. The benefits include the right to work legally, to receive education and health care, and granting a two-step appeals process if an applicant's asylum status is initially denied. Now to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Roberta Montevicchi, a UNHCR spokeswoman and operations assistant in Chad. She began their conversation by praising the new refugee law as a landmark.
It's a major step forward to the country and to the region in general. Chad was the only country in the Western Africa without an asylum law.
How are refugees able to be granted asylum in Chad now? I understand there are two main ways.
Yes. One is to group refugees, which is generally the case, for example, of the Sudanese refugee and refugees that came from the Central African Republic in the past and Nigeria.
When you say a group, do you mean people from one place or people who actually cross the borders physically together into Chad?
The Refugee Convention of 1951 has to have a personal persecution story, while the African Convention speaks more about massive displacement of population across border and massive violation of human rights. So if you belong to that group, you can then be recognized as a refugee. So it's very generous. That's typical in African context.
Other things in which the law of Chad is much more generous is, for example, when it comes to the family reunification principle. Imagine in your country, my country, it will be generally limited to the nuclear family, while in Chad is extending to the extended families, which is more, I would say, fit into the African context.
What's the second major aspect to the new law?
The second part is that it provides freedom of movement of refugees, and it provides access to health care like a right, not just as an entitlement that can happen or not happen, and rights for education, rights to work legally, access to justice, and then family reunification also in a very broad sense. So it's really very good law at the international level and at the regional level.
Why did this law come to pass and why now?
One key moment was the Global Refugee Forum in 2019 when Chad was among the African countries that pledged for improving the legal, physical, material protection of refugees. That was most likely a trigger. And the fact that Chad was maybe the only remaining country in the Central and West Africa without an asylum law, and that is the root of these latest changes. So the law is coming to put an end to a legal vacuum. Well, I have to say that Chad is recognized to be a country with, I would say, legendary hospitality. And you know, now approximately 3% of the population of Chad is made of refugees and displaced people. So in that sense, it's really doing great. So, I mean, it's exemplary.
Tell me, where do most of these refugees come from?
The majority of refugees, approximately 375,000 refugees that are now in Chad, come from Sudan. Then the second biggest group, close to 97,000, are people coming from Central African Republic. And then the last group, Nigerian refugees, about 17,000.
Do these refugees go to camps mostly?
Yes. Majority of refugees now are still in the camps, but then more and more the approach that UNHCR is advocating is breaking the boundaries between the camps and the surrounding villages in order then to be sure that whatever assistance you give to refugees will also benefit the local population. Give you an example. We built in the past health center that were under the refugee program. But now the health center are basically transferred to the ownership of the Chadian government, and the international community is supporting this health center that provide health care to refugees and to the locals, already in a share of 60 to 40%.
This sounds like possibly a more peaceful solution in the long term. As you know, there's often competition and outright conflict between refugees and the local population of the places where they settle. It's certainly true in the U.S., where some people really resent refugees, thinking that refugees take more than their fair share of government resources and jobs.
Yes. So another example we are working on is for the vocational training. So to transfer whatever vocational training center we built to the government and then help the government to make the utmost of this center and to run them. Of course, maybe you need to help them still for some years to come, but that is broadening the access to refugees and host communities. And in that way, you will also prevent or mitigate conflict and to build on synergies rather than divide.
Roberta Montevecchi is a UNHCR spokeswoman in Chad, and she was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to consider an already failed lawsuit challenging the Wisconsin election results. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has those details.
Joe Biden won the state of Wisconsin by some 21,000 votes. But the Trump campaign, which lost an effort in the state Supreme Court to throw out tens of thousands of ballots, is now asking the U.S. Supreme Court to disqualify absentee ballots and others collected by poll workers at non-traditional places because of the pandemic. Trump surrogates are asking the nation's highest court to declare Wisconsin's election failed and allow the state's GOP-controlled legislature to appoint state electors. Trump and his allies have suffered dozens of defeats trying to overturn the November election. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
In addition, a Republican senator says that he will object when Congress meets next week to certify President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the election. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri says he'll protest the Electoral College certification because he asserts that some states, including notably Pennsylvania, didn't follow their election laws. A Biden spokeswoman is dismissing Hawley's move as antics that will have no bearing on Biden being sworn in on January 20th, 2021. Hawley isn't giving specifics or evidence in a statement that he released announcing his intentions. Earlier this month, I spoke with University of California Hastings College of the Law professor Joe Paul about the process.
The electors sign ballots indicating the person to whom they are obliged by law to vote for, and those ballots will then be certified by the governor of the states, and they will be put in envelopes, and they will be mailed to the vice president, who is the president of the Senate. And what then happens is that on January 6th, there's a joint session of Congress The envelopes will be open. The vice president will read out the ballots. They will be tabulated, and they will announce that Joe Biden has a majority of the votes. Now, members of the Senate or the House can object, but under the Electoral Vote Count Act, the law provides that if the electors have been certified, that is to say, if the election has been certified as valid, those electors are presumptively valid. And so unless a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate were to vote together to reject a slate of electors, those electors' votes will count. And since a majority of the House is dominated by Democrats, and it's not at all clear that a majority of Republicans in the Senate would vote to disallow any of the electoral votes, it's pretty clear that there's no way to avoid the result that the president-elect will be Joe Biden.
Joel, what else is there to keep an eye on as this process moves forward?
I would totally expect that the proceedings on January 6th, the joint session of Congress, will include lots of heckling and objections raised by various rogue Republicans. But none of it matters. It's all just noise. And what's really going on here, I think, is an attempt to delegitimate the presidency of Joe Biden.
Joe Paul is a constitutional legal expert at UC Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco. Drone footage captured the aftermath of an earthquake that struck central Croatia on Tuesday, killing at least 7 people and injuring more than 20. Reuters' Adam Reed.
The scale of a second earthquake to hit Croatia in 2 days shone through collapsed buildings and a rising death toll on Wednesday. The most recent quake measured 6.4 and struck in central parts of the country a day earlier, leaving a total of at least 7 people confirmed dead, including a 12-year-old girl. Local media said a kindergarten in the area was also destroyed in the badly hit village of Petrinja, but there were no children in it at the time. Croatian Prime Minister Andrej Plenković has brought in the country's military to support the rescue and aid efforts. Locals are being helped to evacuate parts of the village because it's been deemed too unsafe to remain there. Pope Francis has sent a message of hope to the Croatian people.
I express my closeness to the wounded and to those who were hit by the earthquake, and I pray in particular for those who lost their lives and for their families.
The quake was also felt in Zagreb, where people rushed onto the streets, including at one of the city's main hospitals, leaving many patients sitting in chairs on the street, wrapped in blankets. Dozens more are thought to be injured, with reports of buildings being shaken as far away as Slovenia and the Austrian capital of Vienna, as several aftershocks continued to be felt.
Adam Reed reports for Reuters News. The European Atlas Project studied the ecosystems of the deep Atlantic Ocean. Yesterday, in part one of my conversation with Murray Roberts, professor of applied marine biology and ecology at the University of Edinburgh and project coordinator, we learned that the scientists involved in the deep sea project discovered 12 new species and over 30 species in previously unknown locations. Now today, we continue that conversation by learning how the team took what they learned and turn it into policy recommendations.
So there's a lot of detail. Actually, Atlas worked really hard to get its science right across to policy. And I should also mention we worked right across disciplines as well. So we focus a lot on the science, and there was a lot of science indeed in Atlas, but we worked with people. We worked with socioeconomists, and we worked with local communities. So we had a fully transdisciplinary approach to these problems. But if we think about where the policy messages are, well, number one, we have to get a grip on emissions, not just for deep Atlantic ecosystems, but for the massive changes we're going to see in the weather patterns across the world and the increased storminess and severe effects of climate change that are going to impact ecosystems and people. So we've got to get a grip on emissions. We've got to then, I think, do a far better job of working across sectors. There's no point just having academic scientists working in one bubble and industry working in another. We've got to break those barriers down. And Atlas worked really hard to work directly with industry to be a practical and hands-on project. When we're doing that, then together we can figure out things like, well, where should the protected areas be? You know, there's no point just setting a blanket, let's protect X percentage of the ocean. We have to figure out exactly where to protect. We need to think about how ecosystems are connected one to the other, and we need to figure out where ecosystems are going to be in climate-safe spaces, so-called climate refugia. There's not a lot of point protecting something that in 50 years or maybe 100 years' time will be completely unsuitable for the reason that you protected it in the first place. And then the final one I've got in terms of key policy aspects is really a simple one, and that's to support people to empower international ocean science and capacity building so we can raise the capacities right across the world to deal with these challenges.
Professor Murray, I have one last question for you. This goes back to something that you mentioned earlier, saying that it wasn't all that surprising that you found new species and found new locations for previously known species based on our lack of knowledge about the deep. So as a scientist who was part of this four-year Atlas study, what did you find most interesting and surprising?
Do you know, it was actually the human reaction to the project. So those socioeconomists I mentioned, the social scientists, they did something really smart, actually. They just went to local communities in Canada and Norway and here in Scotland, and they asked people what was their opinion of deep sea diversity and conservation and the various pressures to drive economic growth from the oceans. And actually what people prioritized was long-term sustainability and having ecosystems in a good state to leave to their children. And that surprised the scientists. And we've taken real comfort from that and a great sense of optimism, you know, that people, these are not scientists, these are not people that we're working with, these were people that we had nothing to do with selecting at all in the project. And that really gave us a great sense of optimism for the future, that if we work across sectors and get our heads down and deal with things like the emissions challenges, we can let nature recover.
That's fascinating. Murray Roberts is a professor at the School of Geosciences at the University of Edinburgh. Thank you very much for spending part of your day with us.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to International Edition of the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. You can also listen to our top of the hour newscasts. Until next year, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, have a tremendous Thursday, and a very happy new year.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is imposing sanctions on the Turkish government's Presidency of Defense Industries for procuring the S-400 surface-to-air missile system from Rosoboron Export, Russia's main arms export entity. The sanctions include a ban on all U.S. new export licenses and authorizations to SSB, and an asset freeze and visa restrictions on Dr. Ismail Demir, SSB's president, and three other SSB officers. These sanctions are not intended to undermine the military capabilities or combat readiness of Turkey or any other U.S. ally or partner. Instead, they are intended to impose costs on Russia in response to its wide range of malign activities. The United States made clear to Turkey that its purchase of the S-400 system would endanger the security of U.S. military technology and personnel and provide substantial funds to Russia's defense sector, as well as Russian access to the Turkish armed forces and defense industry. Turkey moved ahead with the procurement and testing of the S-400 despite the availability of NATO interoperable systems to meet its defense requirements. This decision resulted in Turkey's suspension and pending removal from the global F-35 Joint Strike Fighter Partnership. These sanctions send a clear signal that the United States will not tolerate significant transactions with Russia's defense and intelligence sectors. In a written statement, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged Turkey to resolve the S-400 problem immediately in coordination with the United States. Turkey is a valued ally and an important regional security partner for the United States, and we seek to continue our decades-long history of productive defense sector cooperation by removing the obstacle of Turkey's S-400 possession as soon as possible.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.